What kinds of contractual obligations do soccer players, do rugby players, athletes at large get themselves into? And of course, as I did say, we're joined by Themba Zimu, sports lawyer at Team Sugazi Inc., former captain of the UFS football team, and many more other things. Welcome to Kofsi FM, Themba, and thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, please.
What does your work as a sports lawyer entail?
On the day-to-day, as a sports lawyer, I did say it earlier on the sports colloquium that we assist employees. Sports lawyers are employees. So we do, if an employee is dismissed, if an employee is not paid, if an employee is unfairly treated, if an employee has a contractual claim of some sort that needs to be enforced by a sports lawyer, then the same applies to sports players.
And what's the difference between a sports lawyer and an agent?
An agent is in accordance to the new rules, they are actually referred to as the intermediaries. Mm-hmm. So an intermediary is one that will negotiate a contract on behalf of a player with the company. Mm-hmm. So it's to the discretion of the agent if they want to make use of a sports lawyer in those negotiations, mm-hmm. or after the negotiations they can make use of us to actually reduce whatever they were discussing to paper in order to regulate the legal relationship between the club and the player, and also the player and the agents.
And is it possible for a player to have both, to have an agent but also work with the sports lawyer?
It's possible. It's not illegal to do that, mm-hmm. or it's not. It's possible, but mostly how I've seen it set up is that if you sign a contract, maybe your contract will have a clause that even if you have any legal dispute, then the agent will be responsible for procuring you legal services. So mm-hmm. you can have, or the agent themselves, like the former agent, which is my director, Team Sugazi, you can be an agent and a sports lawyer at the same time. Yeah.
Now, working with some of the cases that you deal with players and clubs, what would you say are some of the most ridiculous contractual obligations that you've ever seen a player get themselves into?
Management contracts. So the issues, most issues that are involved in soccer players are always not per se issues between the soccer player and the soccer team. It's the soccer player and the soccer player's agent. Mm-hmm. So the management contracts. You would see other contracts that have clauses like we have full rights, like you were talking about artists. The same applies with the soccer players, where if there's an opportunity that comes through your way for you to be an ambassador of any brand of any nature, then that brand needs to go through an agency, which is fine, but they can't have ownership of all those rights. Mm-hmm. So it's their discretion whether they're going to give you this much, they're going to give you that much. So management procurement agreements, the agreement itself is ridiculous for me, but it's necessary, obviously, to regulate your working relationship.
And you mentioned something about who gets to sit when a new contract is being negotiated or renewals are being negotiated. But one thing that I would like to know is, when negotiating a contract for a player, which factors do you look into to sort of determine the kind of worth and amount of money that they deserve to get paid?
It's longevity, it's experience, it's how the player performs, it's who the player is. It's the financial appetite of the team, mm-hmm. what they are willing to pay for the player. But as a starting point, before even negotiating, the in terms of the rules, the team is the party that's supposed to present a proposal.
Okay.
So that's where that's the minimum that you are working around. So yeah.
So the team makes an offer.
Yeah.
And then you decide whether you want to accept the offer or you want to query the offer, and then you present.
Yeah, but that always falls within the domain of the agent. And unfortunately, it also depends on the agent that you have, how experienced they have. Because if you've been working for a long time as an agent with the soccer player, with mm-hmm. the soccer teams, then the soccer teams, you don't even have to present a player for them to know that that player is worth this much. Mm-hmm. So it depends on the experience of the agent that you have, because if you're having someone with less experience, that they're going to ask you to come, even if you were a good player, you have to trial first, you have to justify, your agent has to justify for you. Mm-hmm. If you have an experienced agent, they put the number. If they're not happy with that, then on to another team.
Now, when you're looking at artists, you'd find that they normally focus on the big amount of money that they're going to get and some of the perks that come with that, but they don't really look into the depths of the contract. So you just want to get 200,000, you want to get car allowance, you want to get housing allowance, yeah. But you don't even query as to whether you own any of those privileges that you are being splashed with. Yeah. When looking at sports law, what exactly is contained in a contract? What are some of those clauses that clubs use to sort of bind players with?
So it's a standard employment. The NSL, being the National Soccer League, has a standard contract for all the players. And then the soccer team and the player have their own contract. And there's a procurement agreement, all of which have to be filed with the PSL upon lodging the contract of the players. Mm-hmm. So it's different here. In an employment contract, you have the normal contractual obligations of you, and it's regulated as well. So you can't sign a player for more than 2 years. You can sign them for 2 years with an option to extend. Mm-hmm. So it's heavily regulated, and it's somewhat of a copy and paste of the Labor Relations Act. Mm-hmm. So what you find in that contract is the same as what you find in a normal employment contract. The binding nature of, say, other things outside of the relationship of a soccer player and a football team is to be found primarily in a management contract, the mm-hmm. procurement contract, again, the agency player situation. So for as far as the relationship between the team and the player is concerned, there are standard contracts that are essentially a copy and paste of the labor relations rules mm-hmm. or employment contract, as you would understand it if you are in a more professional desk boardroom mm-hmm. kind of setup. Mm-hmm. That is there, and then other obligations that are informed by the fact that you have someone who's out there trying to find a team on your behalf or who negotiates on your behalf. So essentially what I just said is reduced into all those clauses or provisions in the contract.
And we say the contract happens to be some kind of a copy of the just basic Labor Relations Act that you know, and under normal circumstances of employer-employee relations.
Yeah.
Now, where does that put unions?
As far as soccer players are concerned, there's only one recognized union in SOC, mm-hmm. well, recognized by FIFA, and there's an overarching agreement that whatever the players, whenever there's a situation with a player involved, and that player is actually registered with that union, because not all of them are registered by the virtue of them being soccer players, they need to actually be represented. For instance, if a soccer player elects to have a management contract with so and so with the soccer with that have their own sports lawyer, then the unions wouldn't actually find application with there. But for laws and everything that deals directly with the general dealings of soccer players, unions always have to be involved. Even if there's a sale of a team for some sort of as a going concern, you would have to involve the union, and you have to have consent, or you have to not consent per se, you have to have meaningful engagement with the union to see whether the players' rights are fully represented.
And there seems to be a number of players, and by players I'm referring to stakeholders in the whole contract thing, because if you have the intermediary, you have the club and their own legal teams, and then you have the sports lawyer, and then you also happen to have somewhere in the mix the unions. But then what I'm interested to know is, how does the hierarchy work? Because when you're looking at just what I would refer to as mainstream law, is where you get the courts, and then you know there's the higher court, then there's the constitutional court, and the Supreme Court of Appeal.
Yeah.
But when it comes to sports law, who does the bug finally stop with, and what's the process? Where do you start with the grievance, and how does it go? How far does it go?
Okay, as an example, if you're a player and you didn't receive your monthly salary, what would then happen is it's either if the player has an agent, the player will tell the agent what is happening. If the player doesn't have an agent and wants to go directly to a sports lawyer, then that's where it will go. If a player has a union representative, then that union representative will come. And then you refer a matter to the, if it's a disciplinary issue, you refer the matter to the NSL DRC. Or just to the NSL, a CCMA equivalent of the sports industry or the soccer industry. So NSL, because there's a misconception about what PSL actually is. So NSL is the governing body of football in South Africa, National Soccer League. Underneath the National Soccer League, you have the PSL and you have the NFD. That's the professional status. And they are governed by their own NSL handbook, which essentially gives out the rights and obligations of players. And if what you are asking, if there's a grievance that happens, the NSL handbook would speak to that. So you refer a matter, and within a month, they need, just like the CCMA, it needs to be solved with expediency. So, so within a month, you'll get a date, it goes there. So after, if you are not happy with what the PSL DRC or any equivalent platform has said, then you can take it to the SAFA tribunals for arbitration. So there's conciliation, then there's arbitration. Then even if you're still not happy, you can go to the courts, the labor courts, just like the IX versus... the IX versus Ndoro case. What happened is they went directly to the High Court, because whatever platform that you may have in your specific sporting field, you're still accountable to the highest court, which is the High Court, not the SCA, and the SCA comes out only after the High Court. So the normal courts still have application and the powers to overrule whatever happens with the tribunals that are created by the NSL handbook. So what they want is you need to solve your cases in accordance to the NSL handbook, and if there's any further grievance, then you still, nothing takes away from your right, inherent right to use what the high courts have, which is inherent jurisdiction to hear everything.
And the kind of conversation that we're having at this point is one of the most important conversations, because so many of our football players go into mainstream football, professional football. They leave the townships, and then when they retire, or if anything happens to them that sort of halts their careers, and they go back to being broke, like Hamotuna Asukaba Palabolo Hohang. And of course, you'd cite things like, you know, lifestyle issues and many more other things, but some of them happen to be the kinds of contractual obligations they got themselves into. And if you're wondering what I'm talking about the discussion that we're having right now with Temba Zimu, who is a sports lawyer, and we're talking about sports law in general and some of the mistakes that athletes make when they enter into agreements. And I think to resume our conversation, Temba, let's look into the different kinds of players that you encounter, and I would make that a bit more contextual by saying you get players that come from the township, and then you get players that come from urban areas, you get players that are educated and players that didn't really pursue education. When it comes to legal literacy, what type of, you know, player do you find easy to work with and frustrating also to work with?
The easiest player would be the one that just wants you to, that just wants you to do everything for them. But at the same time, that's not the person that you want to work with. Do you want to work with? You want to work with someone that wants to make their rights clear and obligations clear, so you actually know what you are doing for the person. The frustrating but more fulfilling player would be the player that's very educated. So for a lawyer, they will question a lot of things that you reduce in writing to their benefit or not. But it's a frustrating or it takes longer to help that kind of player. But at the same time, you are fully aware that player actually knows what they want for themselves, what they want their contracts to speak to. So it's a bit of a nuance there, that it's easier to work with someone that actually just wants a contract. But at the same time, that's not the person that you want. You want an educated person that knows what they want for their career.
And do you ever come across someone who just wants a breakthrough, which means they don't care what's in the contract, or they want to go a hot man like a kupafalan jaka chola di mika ba palabolo and get out of poverty? I don't want all these complications.
To be honest, that would be the general comments or inquiries that I get from people in my capacity as a sports lawyer, mm-hmm. but that's not the scope of my work. If you want a breakthrough and you want assistance, that's the agency work. So the sports mm-hmm. lawyers, our engagement letter does not include finding you a team, does not include doing this. Our engagement letter is, if you have an agency, what does the agent want from us for you? Or if we're dealing with you directly, which is seldom the case if you haven't actually had a contract to deal with, because mm-hmm. you come to us when there's any type of legal relationship that's ensuing.
Mm-hmm. And then also, I lost my train of thought a bit, but well, it's something that we said at the colloquium that we had today. Yeah. When you're talking about also your involvement or your studies in banking law,
yeah.
and you said that it also assists you somehow when you're dealing with the financial aspect of how to advise sports players.
Yeah.
To what extent do you think pursuing that kind of financial background helps you in helping players to understand better what happens in their contracts?
So, over and above me doing banking law as one of my specialities in law, I also study contracts. So my training is to be a corporate and commercial lawyer. So mm-hmm. although I said earlier that sports law is an equivalent of employment law, but at the end of it, or the point of departure between the legal relationship, is what the contract says. What the contract says. So I understand it from my training as a corporate lawyer, and then my involvement in banking transaction advising and drafting of banking contracts would say I was a sports lawyer. So, and there's obviously a recurring problem of financial literacy. Mm-hmm. How do I best serve my client in the two backgrounds that I have, both of corporate and finances? So I think it's very important that you get lawyers that don't just know sports law, but they actually know the business of sports, and just how to reduce everything in writing in a way that speaks not only to what the club wants you to do in the field of play, but when I advise, I also have to think forward for you, because I'm the lawyer. They are the soccer player. They are very good at playing soccer. I'm supposed to be very good at making sure that playing soccer actually benefits them beyond their career.
And you say it's very beneficial to have a lawyer that understands sports law, but also even financing. But also, I think it becomes even much more of a competitive edge, I would say, if the lawyer happens to have a football background, which is what you have.
Yeah.
Do you think you've been able to merge the two, plus the previous experience that you have as a footballer, someone that played for Varsity Cup, was captain of the University of the Free State football team? Are you finding that to be benefiting you somehow, or just one of those experiences you refer to as the good old times?
So where I currently work for, it's not just me who has a football background, hence I wanted to associate myself with that, because you have a much deeper understanding of the players and appreciation of the struggles of the players, and you actually understand that if they don't understand something, it's not because of their own doing, it's just they grew up just wanting to be becoming soccer players. So that in itself, and the directors of our law firm, we all have a similar background. In fact, even more so for them, they've been playing even PSL. So we have a deeper understanding of what the players want.
And I'm glad you're mentioning the previous backgrounds that the other lawyers have, because one of the questions I wanted to ask you, which I can still ask if there's a possibility to respond to, is that most of the players retire into becoming sports commentators and analysts on TV.
Yeah.
And very seldom do we find a case where someone retires from football and then they pursue law as a field, and they come back to use their fame and the influence they have to actually become advocates in the activist and the legal sense of the word of, you know, some of the legal impediments that players find themselves in. How widely known is sports law within the football fraternity?
So you have to know that you need a lawyer. Mm. I don't know whether they know that we are actually specialists in the sports law. It's a niche environment. Even the law students themselves, if I say I'm a sports lawyer, they don't know about that, because it's not that emphasized in our student career. And because modules like sports law, if they are at the university, of which I don't know of, were not given to us when we were there. So I had to do my own research. I had to do my own research as to, does this law actually exist? But the thing is, you always need a lawyer. So if you're a sports player and you have a sports problem, they will refer you to a sports lawyer, and that's where we come in, if that answers your question. There's clarity that's needed there.
I'm not sure if it does, because what I'm trying to get to is, how do we popularize it?
How do you popularize sports law?
Yes, as a field, as a discipline.
So, okay, I even remember the first question as well. So you can't be, if you are playing football professionally, it shouldn't be, and more to your recent question, it shouldn't be a reactive thing. You shouldn't want to study law only after you've played football. That's why it's important for us to study while playing football. You don't have to be a full-time student to have a law degree. You can study part-time. So I think, firstly, in our institutions themselves, there needs to be a sports law course, not as a master's curriculum. And then there's a need to make that education element fashionable, because we're really not saying we want you to have a degree just so you say, as a soccer player, I'm not dumb. That's not the idea
and
behind.
This has always been the conversation. We celebrate you for having a degree, because what we know as a stereotype is that football players don't study.
Yeah, that should never be the narrative that we want to pursue or just carry on enforcing. You don't want to be educated because you want people not to say that you're not educated. You want to get educated so you can cater for your own financial career. If you are educated, then you understand better things. If you're educated, then you are friends with people that can actually steer you into the right direction. So education in itself, there's the lecture part of education. Then there's I'm educated, therefore my friends are educated. If we do that, then we would understand. Even the soccer players themselves would stop associating themselves with people that are not beneficial to their lives.
And I see on Twitter we have Kesa, who is saying that she's talking about the fact that we're having this conversation, but also saying that it's a much more football-focused discussion, and she's interested more in talking about sports at large. And I like the fact that she said that, because the conversation we've been having now has to be some kind of a backdrop into other sporting codes. Yeah. And I know in corporate South Africa we have this issue where we say that black professionals are not paid the same as their white counterparts. Yeah. And that we'd find someone who is less qualified as a white person getting more money than you as a black person who happens to even be their boss.
Yeah.
Now, do we have the same thing when it comes to sports? Because when you're looking at football, it is much more of a black space. Yeah. And then when you're looking at other sports in codes like cricket, like rugby, for example, they are much more whiter.
Yeah.
Do you find a case where in football there's less money, and then in other white spaces you find that players are rewarded much more highly compared to their black counterparts?
I think we should start by, in response to that tweet, contextualize. So you can be a sports lawyer, but as a lawyer you specialize in a field. So my specialization is soccer. But be that as it may, it doesn't take away from the fact that I could take other instructions in other sporting codes. To answer your question, there's investment in sports in South Africa, in soccer in South Africa. Soccer is predominantly having black soccer players. There's a lot of investment, but as a sport itself, just soccer itself, it depends on what kind of the contracts, what kind of sponsorships do the teams have, because teams primarily depend on the grants from the PSA to pay salaries. So that it goes to an association thing. If we're having a conversation of rugby players get more money than soccer players, then it's a, how much money are you giving as PSL to the soccer teams in order for them to pay their players more? Because as Kaizer Chiefs, you have multiple sponsors. Therefore, at Kaizer Chiefs, you'll find that they are getting paid more. At Chippa, you find that they're not getting paid more, not because they shouldn't be getting paid the same as Kaizer Chiefs because they don't have the same resources and sponsorship. So it depends on what kind of grants are focused on. Even if you give a grant, do you actually have a minimum of what you pay your which isn't the case of what you are supposed to pay your players? So I can speak to that, and if there's any disparity between the wages, then it speaks to what is given to the soccer team. And by virtue of the PSL and the NSL having the power to actually say, if I give you this much money, the players are supposed to be paid at least like this. So there are a lot of factors that are involved. And rugby as a white-dominated sport have a lot of sponsors as well. That informs how much money they're getting paid. And you can even take it back to university, where varsity sports has sponsors and varsity football has sponsors, varsity cup has sponsors. How many sponsors do rugby actually have?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're talking about, are they privileged? Do you see the background of what are the rugby people actually doing to get more of the sponsors? That's the unfortunate thing. And for sports and for soccer in the university, what are we actually doing to get more sponsorship so that we can have more money for our players or for the convenience of traveling? So it's a business element to it, and it's a regulatory element from the associations themselves.
And I think I'm going to have to drag you back to the question of financial management. But this time around, I want us to look at the system, because someone might argue and say that most of the players, across all sporting codes, find themselves in financial trouble after retiring, because the system is designed in such a manner that it doesn't really sort of force them or guide them in a legal way to save money or to keep a certain amount where you say this goes to your pension or it goes to... Now, how can we exploit the rule of the law in sports to say, mona ding la warata kapa warat, we're forcing you that you need to save this amount of money and you're not going to get it until a certain amount of time, how about every time?
You can make that argument, but remember, soccer players are major citizens. Soccer players are major citizens. Soccer players can also are supposed to have rights to their money.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that argument or that debate, that conversation shouldn't be had in exclusivity. Because if you're checking me as a lawyer, I, by virtue of my contract, I'm actually forced by my company to take this pension fund,
mm-hmm.
to take this one. So I do agree that there are the bare minimum in terms of regulation that you can actually make the players, force the players to have.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is how those funds are managed. For instance, if I have a retirement fund, for that retirement fund to actually mean something, I have to have a long career, and that's actually the case with say a lawyer, a professional. My career only gets better as I age,
mm-hmm.
but as a sports player, the problem is your career is 5 years, 10 years the most. So how can that have interest? So it's an association thing as well. But I think there's a change. Besides, I don't like to speak about how the soccer players themselves live the fleshy lives.
Mm-hmm.
It's what do you what obligations do you actually make the Asians have? Because Asians, there was an issue about unlawful competition conduct of Asians, about taking a standard 10% of any contract, and I think that was addressed recently. If you're taking 10% of 10,000, that's little. If you're taking 10% of 500,000 of a transfer fee,
mm-hmm.
then your obligations should be tailored to that, to the kind of money that you are making. So I think primarily soccer players' dealings are through the agents, so there should be some sort of obligation on them to actually make sure that those people are okay. And if that obligation is not carried through, there has to be recourse to those agents. And you can do that. The agents, just like the soccer players and the football teams, are regulated by the same rules, so you can bind them in accordance to the same rules. And that doesn't just apply to your soccer, it applies to also rugby. They all, just as soccer has the NSL handbook, rugby also has its own equivalent of and they operate exactly the same.
Earlier when you talked about how you are only allowed to sign a player for a maximum of up to 2 years with the possibility for extension.
Yeah.
And I think I have a problem with that in context of what we've just talked about, in a sense that the law then limits a player's career to intervals of 2 years or 1 year. Why can't we have, let's say, a minimum of 5 years, within which, even if your contract doesn't get renewed, at least you've sort of amassed a particular amount of money that can sustain you beyond? Because I feel like at this point, soccer is becoming a glamorized slave trade. You want this slave for today, tomorrow you want a different slave, you just exchange them all the way through. Are we exploiting the law sufficiently to make the lives of players better?
I'm not sure whether the same applies for rugby, but I would assume that they also have a limited amount of time that you can sign into a contract, because it's a sport. If the minimum is 5 years and within 2 years, it's a sport and it's a business. Mm-hmm. So if after 2 years of your 5 years contract, I can't use you, it means I also the whole rationale of that is, if you're good enough, we can extend. If you're not good enough, we need to make space, funds available for another player. So it's your view and I accept it, but at the same time it's still a business at the end of the day. It's still a business at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's a tough one, balancing between humanity and commerce, capitalism and socialism. Now, before we let you go, as we go in deeper into this, you know, legal muddy waters that we're dealing with in sports, there's a perception that South African football is very corrupt, from unions to intermediaries to even just the leaders, PSL, SAFA. And I'm not going to ask you whether that's true or not, because I think...
Because I can't answer that.
Yes, but what I'm going to ask you is, as a lawyer, as a sports lawyer, do you think the existing sports legislation is tough enough to sort of not only detect when someone is doing something unlawful, but also to even punish them?
My own personal opinion is, if you look at the NSL handbook, and anyone has access to that, not just the sports lawyers, anyone can easily just Google National Soccer League handbook, and you find how to be part of the executive, for instance, how to be part of the executive committee of the PSL. You actually need to own a team. So that actually, now where are the checks and balances? If the owners of the team are the ones that are actually running even the league. So I think there's more to be done, especially on the legislation, because how it's drafted, that there are no I find it difficult to see how you can hold yourself accountable or hold your own team accountable if something is happening. If you are the soccer owner and at the same time you are the executive committee, you run the team. But that's a known thing, that other people are leaders in the PSL, but at the same time have their own soccer league. And it's actually that, because the law says it should be like that. It's not them. Or it's them that actually promulgate those things, but it's actually a rule that if you want to go to be in that position, you have to have a substantial interest in a soccer team by virtue of ownership.
And I think in closing our conversation then, I want us to have a revision of what we've been talking about. But this kind of revision should be directed towards a person that says, I'm at the beginning stages of my football career, or my, you know, any form of just, you know, being an athlete.
Yeah.
And I want to know now, as a student, as a young person listening, Hore, what are the basic things that I need to be aware of at the beginning of my career? What is the starter pack for someone who wants to get into sports?
The unfortunate one is you need an intermediary if you want to get anywhere. You need an agent if you want to get anywhere. But with that said, you need to know that the agents are not your friend. The agents they work for you. You have the talent. So you are negotiating. When you get into any kind of negotiation with a soccer team or with an agent, you are negotiating from a point of strength, not weakness, because you are the asset. So you need to make sure that you educate yourself. Even me as a lawyer, I I have to study this. If I'm specializing in this, I have to study my whole life. So it shouldn't be different for a soccer player. We're not asking you to be a student athlete your whole life. Make sure that you educate yourself about your rights in terms of the contracts that you're having. If you don't have an agent, take it through a lot of students that can read it and actually just dumb it down for you, if I may put it that way, or in layman terms, so that this is what you are contracting. This is what you are contracting for. So you need an agent. You need a good work ethic, a great work ethic, and you need to know. You need to educate yourself from the start. You need not to be reactive at the end of your career and say, I need to study for 4 years to become a lawyer. Only when you can see that the money is going to dry up. When you start, you need to make sure that you have what it takes for you to continue beyond your playing career.
And that was Themba Zimu, who was enlightening us as far as sports law is concerned. Putting us at exactly 2 minutes ahead into 7 o'clock, this is Kofsi FM 97.0. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to the interview. And remember, I said on the other side of 7 o'clock, we're going to be welcoming our resident book reviewer. Her name is Refilwe Zimu. We're going to be looking at the life and times of Stephen Bantu Biko from a literary point of view. But at exactly 7 o'clock, Retabile Mabi is going to be coming through, giving us the news updates. Let's do this. When we come back, Retabile. It's Kofsi FM 97.0. Thank you for tuning in.
This is Kofsi FM 97.0.